The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
What are you doing in the land of Zedor?
We're travelers.
The woman who shows herself, is she your wife?
My companion.
And you?
Companion to both.
This machine, how does it move? It's a solar craft. Gets its power from the sun. Isak, search it.
We have nothing to hide.
Very well.
All we have are a couple of blankets and a little water in my friend's toolkit.
I'm a sort of engineer.
And what is this?
It's an audio book from before the nuclear wars. We found it in one of the old cities.
There are no books permitted here except our holy books. Did you have permission to cross our borders?
We didn't know.
I spoke to him, woman!
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, January 18th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
No book but the holy book. To be able to know just what book that might be depends upon the person uttering that statement and knowing which of the world's competing holy books is the one the speaker supports. Once again, I find myself a bit at odds and very uncomfortable with what many religious voices have been saying, purportedly in the name of freedom, even though I may be supporting their cause in a given instance. You might recall that on our show last week, we featured a warning by Executive Director of Rights Probe and Professor of Law at Queen's University, Bruce Pardee, regarding some breaks in the perceived alliance on the right between what he called virtue people, meaning predominantly religious and Christian, and freedom people, meaning predominantly secular and more individualistic. Turns out he wasn't alone making that observation, which was shared by one other particular virtue person whose interview on a recent Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson show left me feeling, as I said earlier, at odds and very uncomfortable with being associated with the views he was expressing. And if there's a break between the virtue people and the freedom people, then it might be even more so that there's a serious break within the virtue community itself. Now, I do not regard any of this as being good news or a desirable condition for the creation of a united right capable of defeating a long-existing united left. And the latest battlefront turns out to be on the issue of sex, although even on that topic, there is no consensus or even agreement on what aspect of sexuality should be of public concern. Quite frankly, I have long been at a loss to understand in any objective or concrete terms just what is meant when Christians, in particular, suggest that the only way out of our current political and social and moral crisis is Jesus Christ, or God, or any other religious practice or idea. My frustration is compounded by the fact that I do support the work and efforts of many of these virtue people, quote-unquote, who could include anyone from Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson to Alex Jones to Stu Peters and many others I could name. But when someone like, say, Stu Peters, for example, conducts a great interview featuring a medical, scientific, or political issue with great complexities, he'll often conclude with an emphatic insistence that we must all return to God or to Christ to resolve the given crisis. To me, as a primarily secular person, that doesn't sound like any kind of solution, but rather it sounds like sort of giving up and submitting to a que sera sera ideology. Moreover, in my political experience over the past half century, I have never associated any particular religious belief with either the left or the right side of the political polarity. I would put it to you that most adherents of the left, which is the polarity of tyranny, are comprised of a majority of Christians, a majority of Muslims, a majority of atheists, a majority of any particular subgroup. Meanwhile, adherents on the right, meaning individual freedom and capitalism, are supported by a minority of all the same religious and non-religious groups I just mentioned. So, sex, politics, religion, once the three taboo subjects never to be discussed around the dinner table, will become the theme of our broader discussion today. Over the course of today's broadcast, you'll be hearing from some very different perspectives and voices on these issues, and it all begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ, Channel 292, and WTWW Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Well, we've got a lot of ground to cover today, so I thought we'd begin right away with that Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson interview I mentioned earlier, an interview conducted on January 11th, and which left me feeling a little uncomfortable with the so-called Christian position on sexuality and morality. And I got the impression, and I could be wrong, but I got the impression that Laura Lynn herself, another Christian, also felt a bit uncomfortable with what she was hearing. But maybe I'm overreacting. Decide for yourself.
What a guest we have. I hope you heard me before the opening of the show, and that is that we're talking about sex today. I mean, we have absolutely lost our way in this world. You can't watch anything, you know, on television or, you know, without having your eyes scarred. Something is being shoved in front of you that's ruining the sexuality. Also, we're wanting to, you know, raise up a generation that has good values on all of these issues. Do you know, freedom was God's idea. And that's why I think it's a really cool thing that we're all fighting for freedom. But with freedom comes responsibility. Andrew DiBartolo, I just want to welcome you to the show. Thank you very much for waiting in the wings. And you are going to be doing something very cool coming up here. And you're here to talk about it and give us your worldview perspective.
A little bit of history. 2 years ago, almost to the day, Bill C-4 received royal assent in Canada, so it became law. And Bill C-4, for anyone who doesn't know, is the anti-conversion therapy law, which essentially deems a biblical Christian worldview and perspective on marriage and sexuality as being a harmful myth and stereotype. And to say to someone that it is preferred that you pursue and you adopt God's standard for sexuality instead of the world's, that is now criminalized, that engaging in conversion therapy or saying to someone, if you're a man, you cannot have sex with a man. And if you're a man and you think you're a woman, you're actually a man, that's illegal. And advertising for conversion therapy is also illegal. So what we and a number of pastors decided to do was tell the state that you have no authority to dictate what happens in the pulpits, and you certainly have no authority to define marriage and sexuality. So we committed to preaching on the first Sunday after Bill C-4 became law, a message on sexual ethics and God's design for marriage. And we committed to doing it every year on the anniversary of Bill C-4. And so every year, the second or third Sunday in January, we call on faithful men in Canada, and now, interestingly enough, around the world as well. We have several brothers in the United States, Germany, Australia, and England that we know of that will be joining, preaching a message that in their countries is still legal, but in many ways in our country, it is illegal to stand in front of a group of people and tell them to pursue God's sexual norms as being right and preferred. Let's assume that someone who I've known for many years, or someone who just finds out about me through the internet or through the work that we do, and they want to meet with me and have coffee. We're sitting down, we're having coffee, and they say, you know, Andrew, I'm a man, I believe in God, and I believe that God's design for marriage and sexuality is right, but I have these weird desires where I desire to be with another man sexually, and I even feel like maybe I'm a woman inside of a man's body, like maybe I'm actually a woman. if I were to say to that person, well, number one, you're not a woman, you're a man, because God's made you a man. There's more than just the plumbing, maleness and femaleness. They're identity markers that God makes men and women with roles and functions and purposes. So you're a man, doesn't matter what you feel like. And number two, you cannot engage sexually with another man. That's a sin. That's an abomination. That's against nature. If I were to tell that person that and call them to abandon sexual immorality and embrace God's design for sexuality, that is illegal. That carries with it up to a $500,000 fine and up to 5 years in prison. So that is now law in Canada.
So, Andrew, are you finding that pastors are willing to do this, or are you also finding that there are some that are not going to touch this subject?
So I would say, by and large, the broad Christian church is unwilling to intentionally preach a message in defiance of godless legislation in the hopes that people will be converted and turn from their sin to Christ, but also to let the state know you don't define marriage and sexuality, and you certainly do not get to determine what comes from the pulpit.
Is it cowardice, or are they compromised in their understanding of biblical sexuality?
Could be one or the other or both. It could be that they're soft on biblical sexual ethic. It could be that they either are compromising their beliefs, that they believe that there is such a thing as a gay Christian, which there isn't, or that they would say, well, you know, orientation is different from practice. You can be attracted to men. That's not a big deal as long as you don't do anything about it, which again is thoroughly unbiblical, because Paul tells us in Colossians 3 to put to death what is sinful in you. And one of the things he lists is evil desires. And desiring to have sex with a man, if you're a man, is an evil desire, and it must be put to death, and it must be brought to Christ to be transformed. So guys are soft on their biblical sexual ethic, so they think that it's not a big deal. Cowardice is a lot of it.
What do you say to someone who says, well, this is hate speech? You're spewing hate speech in Canada.
Well, I guess it would depend on the context. So if I'm having that discussion with another professing Christian who's saying this is hateful speech, this is hateful rhetoric, I would say to them, as a brother, as kind as I can, that's stupid and unbiblical, and you need to get your mind in the scriptures and out of the culture. Like, you're letting the world define things. The Lord Jesus Christ is the eternal Word of God. He's the Logos of God, and the Father speaks the universe into existence, and the power that brings the universe into existence is the Word of God. That's Christ. In Hebrews, it tells us that he holds the world together by the word of his power. So God's all about words, and God gets to define what words mean and what we are and are not allowed to say. And saying to someone that you must turn from your sin and obey Christ, saying to them that it is an abomination if a man lies with a man, that sodomy is a great evil, that's not hateful. That's true. And it's actually loving to call people to repent, and it's loving to expose their sin. It's very unbiblical. So I would be stronger with the professing Christian. To the non-Christian who would say that that's hate speech, I would say again, well, no, it's not hate speech. There's a God or there isn't a God, and he exists. He gets to define reality, not you. And we will be obedient to what he says. And your problem's not with me, your problem's with him. You hate him. You hate his law. But you need to bend the knee in obedience to him, because he alone gets to define things and what's right and what's wrong.
Right. So in a free country like ours, I get along actually with some people that are gay, because I'll have conversations with them. And one guy, he told me that he and his partner thought that gay marriage was a joke anyways. He said, gay people don't want to be married. They're largely like they change partners a lot, for one thing. Not that many want to actually get married. And they never found the value in that. And they did think that was a heterosexual thing, but it became a very politically driven initiative. So But I'm able to get along with them because they believe in freedom, and they believe that I don't have to believe that it's okay to be gay by the Bible. And yet we could still, you know, we can still have conversation. We still live in the same country. We might even vote for the same party. Where has that civility gone?
It depends on the person. You know, I had an experience after the convoy. After the convoy ended, I've had a number of these people who shortly thereafter reached out to me and said, oh, you're a pastor. Oh, you're a Christian. Well, you know, I thought I gave up on the church, but maybe I'll check out your church. Maybe, you know, if you're a Christian and you're standing for freedom and you're a pastor, then maybe I shouldn't give up on Christianity altogether. So as they started expressing what seemed to be an interest in my church and what was going on, then they would inevitably ask, well, what's your position on LGBT issues? To which I would say very politely and very simply that we believe that God has created marriage to be for one man and one woman in covenant for life, and that anything other than that, any sex outside of that, whether it's a man and a woman who aren't married or two men and two women, anything outside of that is a sin. It's against nature and it's wrong and it cannot be affirmed. And a number of these people then said to me, you're just as bad as Trudeau, telling people what they can and can't do. You're also tyrant-like. You see, I was right about all your Christians. You're all the same. You're all homophobic. And, you know, some of those conversations ended civilly, some didn't. So my experience is that people in the freedom movement who we're able to link arms with in certain areas, once we start getting down to some other areas, namely positions on sexuality, baby murder, then all of a sudden these divisions that clearly exist with those who love Christ and those who hate him, they become a little bit more pronounced. And so I think there can be a measure of civility when there's a potentially greater threat or a greater harm on the horizon. But once things settle a little bit, all of a sudden what we see is these fractures or these fault lines within the freedom movement. Those people who are for freedom as God defines it, and those people who are for freedom as they define it, what we start to realize is we're not actually allies. We're kind of more co-belligerents when it's really bad. But when it settles, what we find out is if anyone who is not in Christ hates God, which that's Paul's point in Romans 8, the mindset on the flesh is hostile to God. It's at enmity with God. It can't please God. It does what's contrary to God. Then the mind that it's set on the flesh, which is the person who does not submit to and love Christ, if that person hates God and that person hates Christ, then that person ultimately hates his law and also hates the people who have submitted to his law. And so we can only kind of be friendly and work together insofar as people don't kind of vocalize their hatred for God and his law. Because when they do, we realize actually we're far more divided than we thought.
So never mind just the divide between the virtuous people and the freedom people that Bruce Party warned against. Clearly, there is an even greater divide between the virtuous people within their own identified community. Hence, the great number of religions in the world, so often in conflict and at war with one another, a phenomenon we shall examine shortly. Methinks that Andrew DiBartolo doth protest too much. His focus on sexual relationships between members of the same sex belies his contention that sodomy is a great evil. Is he not aware that sodomy, that is, oral and anal sex, is practiced by more heterosexual people than by gays and lesbians, just on the sheer number of them, and often within the confines of a faithful marriage? Is he unaware of all the studies, for example, on pornography, showing that married couples are among its greatest consumers? And why even bother to bring any of this up if he believes that any sexual activity outside the, quote, God-created marriage for one man and one woman for life is a sin ideology? That would include common law relationships, people who are single and rely on masturbation for their sexual release, and who knows what other possible circumstances of living outside his prescribed marriage scenario. Quote, the mind set on the flesh is hostile to God, end quote, he insists, when it seems to me that by his own frame of reference, God created the mind to be focused on the flesh, for how else would humanity procreate? There is no such thing as a gay Christian, he argues, although I can speak from personal experience that I have met such people, and it doesn't matter to him whether any such gays do not even engage in gay sex. The mere desire or erotic fantasy of having sex with another person of the same sex is pure evil. In his philosophy, a person is to be totally defined by their thoughts, not by their actions, which is contrary to all working codes of morality with which I am familiar. De Bartolo argues that, in the case where a man thinks he's a woman, this is not so because God made you a man. Well, that's a very vague reason. The reason is because he has a penis. You don't require any belief in a deity to arrive at such a conclusion. And when he says that God assigns purposes to the sexual act, what are they? Is pleasure not one of those purposes? If strictly procreation, then he has reduced humans to the status of animals, where morality is not an issue in any context. Every act of sex would have to be performed in the not too inappropriately named missionary position. I think he is preaching a form of hate speech, and he's free to do so. But I was pleasantly surprised that Laura Lynn even raised that question, and he's hiding his hate behind what might be called Christian virtue signaling, which is kind of what I'm seeing too much of lately. He says, sodomy is a great evil. That's not hateful. It's true. And it's actually loving to call people to repent and expose their sin, he says. Well, personally, I think this guy's obsessed with the sexual practices of other people, which is, quite frankly, none of his business. He's projecting his sense of morality onto others, which serves no purpose other than to virtue signal, a dubious virtue at best. God is all about words, he says, and gets to define what words mean. Well, actually, the definition of words is determined by what those words describe in reality, and this falls under the discipline of epistemology, not under the interpretations of what one person believes God is saying through his chosen holy book. All quote-unquote holy books were written by people, not by a deity. And that is not to say there are no truths to be found in any such books. Now, just to muddy the waters of faith and belief even further, coming up next, from a debate that took place about 11 years ago, on February 4th, 2013 to be precise, are, on this side of the upcoming bumper, the late Christopher Hitchens, long known for his atheism, and on the return side of the bumper, Tariq Ramadan, a practicing Muslim spokesman, who were both invited to a forum to answer the question, is Islam a religion of peace? And to my own shock and amazement, both speakers appeared to agree that there is no such thing as a quote-unquote religion of peace.
I have to be brief, so I'll be terse. Like a number of people who are students of religion, I've spent a lot of time lately, as you should if you have the opportunity, I recommend it very highly, with Professor Dermot McCulloch's History of Christianity, a marvelous work of scholarship and literature, written by a mainstream believer, extraordinarily broad and deep, in which he ponders one very important question. What happened to the word Christendom? Remember, there used to be such a term. It used to extend across the world, and the hope is that it would extend even further. And it was unironically used to mean those areas of human civilization, and areas yet to be civilized, of course, where the word of Jesus Christ reigned or would reign. And it's all gone. The word is never used except historically or sarcastically now. See, it didn't really end, he said, till 1914, when all the Christian empires of the world, Austria-Hungary, Germany, France, Britain, France is a slight exception to this, but only a slight one, and Russia, all of them commanded by Christian emperors and calling upon their subjects as Christians, went to war with each other and very nearly destroyed the whole human civilization. Out of that came the terrors of fascism and of Stalinism, of which it was the seedbed as well. I mention this partly because I want to maintain that there's no such thing as a religion of peace by definition. There was another empire involved in that war, the Ottoman Empire, which also came to an end. Its other name was the Caliphate, the Muslim Caliphate. It went to war on the side of German and Austrian imperialism and Hungarian imperialism, and it lost not just the war, having proclaimed a worldwide jihad against Christianity, except for German and Austrian and Hungarian Christianity, which were its allies. And it didn't just lose the war, but by 1924 had been dissolved by the Turkish leadership, by Ataturk. It lost the caliphate. And that's the only one that still has supporters. The other Christian and religious empires have all gone. But the caliphate still has fans, not just in the Muslim world, sometimes referred to by Muslims as the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam, but also in what some Muslims call the Dar al-Harb, the House of War, the part of the world that isn't yet Muslim. There are caliphate clubs in London now and Berlin and elsewhere, quite important ones. And what I want to know is why that is and what we should think about it. Believers in this fantasy have, Laurie's spared me the need to say much of this, have committed extraordinary atrocities in Istanbul, in Madrid, in India, in the Philippines, in Indonesia, and of course in our own fair city. And the pretexts for it vary. They can be, the excuse for the mass murder can be that Australia has helped East Timor become independent from Indonesia. They can be that Newsweek has printed a false story about the desecration of a supposedly holy book. You never know what it's going to be next. But everyone knows to be careful about it, and everyone understands that the threat of violence that backs it is believable. Now, you will say, I can hear it already being said, you may be saying it already to yourselves. You may say, ah, that's not the real Islam. Those aren't real Muslims. Now, isn't that a fascinating objection? Is anyone in this room who would care to arbitrate that question? Who is to say? Where is the authority that defines who is a true son of the prophet or a true interpreter of his work? Part of the problem to begin with, and it's part of the problem because it is a religion, is that it's perfectly true to say we don't know who the true Muslims are. It has to do with the fact that it's highly fissile and highly schismatic, that there is a civil war going on within it, the religion of peace. The first reason, though, is this. Islam makes very large claims for itself. Very large claims indeed. It claims to be the last and final religion, the last and final revelation. When you see bumper stickers, everyone says you can't reduce major things to a bumper sticker. It's not my idea to have bumper stickers saying Islam is the solution. It's a well-known slogan, actually, of parties associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. They say Islam is the solution for everything. It takes care of all your life and the one to come. Sexuality, political economy, banking, diet, relations with other religions, everything. It's a total solution. What is creepy about the word total? I hope I don't have to tell an audience like this. It's the first five letters of the word totalitarian. The claim to govern everything from hygiene to sex and the afterlife, which contains detailed prescriptions for the good and bad versions of itself, again strikes me as somewhat totalitarian. And they're both based upon two very, very questionable and not very peaceful concepts. One is the idea of a perfect human being, the Prophet Muhammad, and the other is the idea of a perfect book, the Quran, the recitation. Now, the category perfect human primate or mammal and the category flawless book that could possibly not use any kind of change, revision, or editing are categories that do not exist. There are no members of these categories. Therefore, any challenge to this faith is bound to lead to heresy and to schism, and does. And just as all forms of absolutism and totalitarianism, leader worship and revealed truth, unalterable text, always do, because they can break, perhaps, but they cannot bend. And thus the latent potential of violence between them, among them, as well as within them, is very great. And at any moment, someone is in danger of being accused of being an apostate or an unbeliever. Now, demands that you believe the impossible do not lead to peaceful outcomes. Nor do they lead to peaceful or tolerant regimes. Sexual repression doesn't lead to peace. The idea that women are inferior to men is a profound cause of unease, let's say, the least of it. All religions make some form of this claim. Islam seems to make it less apologetically than most. Claims that the world will come to an end in an apocalyptic form, which will lead to the victory of one religion or another, are not peaceful either.
When I got the question, of course, as a Muslim and as a believer, but as someone who is coming from within the realm of religions, it was quite clear that to put it that way was not the right question to ask. Is Islam a religion of peace, or is Christianity, or is Judaism, or is Buddhism a religion or a spirituality of peace? Doesn't mean anything for me. It's not the right question. It's not the accurate question. Not because I think that there is a good Islam and the right Islam, and there are people who are acting in the name of Islam who are not representing what Islam is. This is not my point. I never said that, by the way. But the point for me is really to try to deal with a phenomenon, with religion from within, and to try to understand the dynamics and to understand the trends and to understand the diversity. So just to essentialize one religion by saying it's all about war, it's all about peace, and even, you know, said by George W. Bush, doesn't mean anything for me. But religions and all the religions and Islam, among all the other religions, are dealing with human beings. And if you deal with human beings, you deal with violence and you deal with peace. You deal with violence. Because human beings, by definition, have to do with violence. They have to deal with aggressivity, with wars. And to expect from a religion not to tackle the issue is just to dream of something which is not going to happen. All the spirituality, go for Buddhism or go for the Bhagavad Gita, you deal with violence. So this is it. Now, what is the answer coming from religions and from trends when it comes to violence and to peace? This is the right question for me. Do we have something which is coming and helping us to go towards peace? This is, for me, the right question. We speak about Islam and we speak about, you know, something which is a religion that is perceived through one window or through one interpretation, and we very often take what is visible through the media. But Islam is as complex as Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism and Hinduism. It's a diversity of interpretations. Yes, you are right. The Quran is, for the Muslims, the very word of God. But many interpretations and many ways of dealing with the books. The problem is not the book, the problem is the reader. This is why when, for example, you take a text, and you can do this with the Bible, with the Torah, the Gospels, it's always the same. Tell me the way you read, I will know what is in your mind, but not for sure what is in the text. And this is something which is the starting point of a serious discussion in theology. Because I don't like all these intellectuals and philosophers and even journalists. They are very keen on understanding the complexity of philosophies and the simplicity of religions. That's not right. And the one to blame sometimes are the religious people themselves. Because the way they present their religion is something which is all of dream and hopes and not dealing with the reality, which is a complex reality. And this is where I think we have to come to a better understanding. So very often when I deal with such topics, I just have to start with the very beginning. We want to deal with the religion. Let us speak about religious issues and religious understanding. For example, coming from a religious viewpoint, I wouldn't say Islam is a religion of peace. I say Islam is a religion for human beings. It deals with peace and it deals with violence. And it helps the people to go from violence towards peace. It's a way towards peace, but it's not a peaceful reality. Peace is a process through which you have, it's a process that you get at the end of a self-education. Educate yourself to get this inner peace. This is coming from the universal message of all the religions. You get this in Buddhism before even speaking, or not even speaking about one God, but you get it in Judaism, you get it in Christianity. Educate yourself to get that peace. So you have to deal with your inner wars and tensions. So this is the way we have to deal with the issue about peace. And the starting point is spirituality. Why? Because at the end of the day, it's really something which is important. And this is the difference that you can find between Islam and the Greek tradition. If you come back to Socrates, Socrates was saying, your body in itself is bad. And this is why you have the soul helping you to educate your body and to master your body. In Islam, there is nothing like that. Your body is not bad, is not good, and your soul is not bad, is not good. It depends on what you are going to make out of it. It's your responsibility because you are free. Your dignity is in your freedom, and you have to use your freedom to make it bad or to make it good. Take the good decision for your body, that's good. Make the bad decision, that's bad. So it's all a question of educating yourself with your own body. And it's exactly the same when it comes to the understanding of the world.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Those last comments made by Tarek Ramadan certainly contrasted greatly with those made by Andrew DiBartolo, who argued that the Bible is the Word of God, while for Muslims, the Quran is the Word of God. Another great divide. And when Ramadan argued that the problem is not the book, the problem is with the reader, tell me how you read, and we will see what is in your mind, but not in the text. Well, that's exactly the thought I had in noting that DiBartolo doth protest too much with his apparent obsession over homosexuality. And while I'm very pleased to hear that Ramadan holds freedom to be the dignity of humanity, I have to question whether that is actually a value held by most Muslims. Where were all the Muslims speaking out against the violation of the freedom of Christians when the circumstances called for it? You know, it was hard not to notice that Christians as a group were among the first politically and criminally targeted by the Trudeau fascist government. During the COVID fraud and lockdowns, Christian pastors and ministers were all being shut down or arrested, while Muslim worshippers attending their mosques were being guided into parking lots by the police at the very same time. Where were the Muslim freedom fighters then? But they sure wasted no time politically organizing when they objected to their children being sexually indoctrinated in our public schools. Makes you start wondering whether religious beliefs are more about sex than they are about freedom. And as if religion and philosophy weren't grounds enough to divide people, suddenly we were being told not to follow our own principles and beliefs, but to follow the science. And this is nothing new, as the Christian writer Isabel Patterson, in her book The God of the Machine, written in 1943, explains, and I quote, "While the United States was in the making as a few happily neglected colonies, something happened to European thought by way of science. It reverted to determinism in the social and political sphere. Free will as a positive doctrine was the original affirmation of Christianity. The mechanistic philosophy is a very late importation to America, and it is wholly imported. But what Europeans wanted was something that would run itself, and humanity with it, requiring nothing of men except passive submission. Before the end of the 18th century, Europe was asking in plain words for a dictator. Though they talked of science, they did not give themselves the trouble to use the scientific method of definition of terms. They used the words monarchy, democracy, and republic interchangeably and most conveniently for any dictator who might take advantage of their standing offer. A scientific, not a moral culture. The slaughter and starvation of millions of people selected as victims specifically because of their productive character and free intelligence was the long-term result of the mechanistic view of the universe. In the early mythologies, the persistent dreams of eternal youth, beauty, and power were imagined as gifts of the gods to some fortunate mortals. With the dawn of science, the hope was transferred to expectation of an elixir of life, to be discovered by research. In mechanics, a similar impossibility was imagined, a perpetual motion machine. Here, genuine science confronts a difficulty, so far unsolved, in defining energy or discovering its ultimate properties. Strict science is confined to measure. Its findings must be quantitative. Dealing with inorganic matter, science postulates the second law of thermodynamics, which says that energy, quote-unquote, runs down by conversion from a kinetic to a static manifestation. If this is so, the universal energy must be a fixed quantity and must also be subject to the second law of thermodynamics, by which the whole universe is bound to run down ultimately to become a motionless, frozen, lightless mass, absolutely static, so to remain forever after. The religious hypothesis of the nature of the universe is actually much more rational, postulating a first principle, God, the source of energy, which does not run down, is not measurable, and is manifest to our rational faculties in both eternal and temporal aspects by the measurable phenomenon of inorganic matter and through the rational faculty itself, which is of the non-measurable order, indicating a divine element in man, the immortal soul. On such a first principle, the universe need not run down. The phases of inorganic elements which are subject to the second law of thermodynamics would be secondary to the creative first principle, which completes an eternal circuit, eternally self-renewing through further processes man has not yet fathomed, end quote. And while we're on the subject of following science, here are the words of another Christian philosopher, John McMurray, quote, "Science and religion are not concerned with two different worlds, but with one and the same world. There cannot be two truths about the same world. Truth is one and indivisible. Science does not worship. It inquires, analyzes, classifies, and does sums. On the other hand, religion is not merely worship, and worship may be mere superstition. If superstitious worship is religion, then astrology and palmistry are sciences. Religion cannot simply sit down and worship anything and everything. It must claim reality for what it worships, and it must make some statement about this reality and assert not merely that it is true, but that it is the supreme truth. A religious temper, which is indifferent to any truth, scientific or otherwise, is ipso facto superstitious," end quote. Well, it seems to me that the bottom line for most people of goodwill in their pursuit of either a religious or secular philosophy is to, quote-unquote, do good. But even given that benign and well-intentioned motivation, it would appear that getting people to cooperate in the formation of a truly free society is not as straightforward as we might like to believe. Here is Alan Watts speaking to a long-known truth that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as found in an after-school production of December 22nd, 2020.
You see, the reason you want to be better is the reason why you aren't. We aren't better because we want to be. Because the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Because all the do-gooders in the world, whether they're doing good for others or doing it for themselves, are troublemakers. On the basis of kindly let me help you or you'll drown, said the monkey, putting the fish safely up a tree. We white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, British, German, American, have been on a rampage for the past 100 or more years to improve the world. We have given the benefits of our culture, our religion, our technology to everybody, except perhaps the Australian Aborigines. And we have insisted that they receive the benefits of our culture, even our political styles, our democracy. You had better be democratic, or we'll shoot you. And having conferred these blessings all over the place, we wonder why everybody hates us. See, because sometimes doing good to others, and even doing good to oneself, is amazingly destructive. Because it's full of conceit. How do you know what's good for other people? How do you know what's good for you? If you say you want to improve, then you ought to know what's good for you. But obviously you don't. Because if you did, you would be improved. So we don't know. It's like the problem of geneticists. which they face today. I went to a meeting of geneticists not so long ago where they gathered in a group of philosophers and theologians and said, now look here, we need help. We now are on the verge of figuring out how to breed any kind of human character we would want to have. We can give you saints, philosophers, scientists, great politicians, anything you want, just tell us what kind of human beings ought we to breed. So I said, how will those of us who are genetically unregenerate make up our minds what genetically generate people might be? Because I'm afraid very much that our selection of virtues may not work. It may be like, for example, this new kind of high-yield grain which is made, and which is becoming ecologically destructive. When we interfere with the processes of nature and breed efficient plants and efficient animals, there's always some way in which we have to pay for it. And I can well see that eugenically produced human beings might be dreadful. We could have a plague of virtuous people. Do you realize that? Any animal considered in itself is virtuous. It does its thing. But in crowds, they're awful. Like a crowd of ants or locusts on the rampage. They're all perfectly good animals, but it's just too much. I could imagine a perfectly pestiferous mass of a million saints. So I said to these people, look, there's the only thing you can do. Just be sure that a vast variety of human beings is maintained. Don't, please, breed us down to a few excellent types. Excellent for what? We never know how circumstances are going to change and how our need for different kinds of people changes. At one time, we may need very individualistic and aggressive people. At another time, we may need very cooperative, team-working people. At another time, we may need people who are full of interest in dexterous manipulation of the external world. At another time, we may need people who explore into their own psychology and are introspective. There is no knowing. But the more varieties and the more skills we have, obviously, the better. So you see, here again, the problem comes out in genetics. We do not really know how to interfere with the way the world is. The way the world actually is an enormously complex, interrelated organism. The same problem arises in medicine because the body is a very complexly interrelated organism. And if you look at the body in a superficial way, you may see there's something wrong with it. Here's chickenpox. And there's spots that itch that come all out all over the place. Well, you might say, well, spots are there, cut them off. So you kill the bug. Well, then you find you've got real problems. Because you had to introduce some bugs to kill the bug. It's like bringing rabbits into Australia. And that starts going all over the place and getting out of hand. But then you think, well, now, wait a minute. It wasn't the bugs in the blood. There are bugs all over the place. What was wrong with this person that his blood system suddenly became vulnerable to those particular bugs? His resistance wasn't up. Therefore, what you should have given him was not an antibiotic, but vitamins. Okay, so we're going to build up his resistance. But resistance to what? I mean, you may build up resistance to this and this and this class of bugs, but then there's another one that loves that situation and comes right in. See, we always look at the human being medically in bits and pieces because we have heart specialists, lung specialists, bone specialists, nerve specialists, and so on. And they each see the human being from their point of view. There are a few generalists, but they realize the human body is so complicated that no one mind can understand it. And furthermore, supposing we do succeed in healing all these people of their diseases, what do we then do about the population problem? I mean, we've stopped cholera, the black bubonic plague, we're getting the better of tuberculosis, we may fix cancer and heart disease. Then what will people die of? Well, they'll just go on living. There'll be enormous quantities of us. Then we have to fix this birth thing. Pills for everybody. Then we find, what are the effects, the side effects of those pills? What are the psychological effects upon men and women of not breeding children in the usual way? We don't know. And what seems a good thing today, or yesterday, like DDT, turns out tomorrow to have been a disaster. What seemed in the moral and spiritual sphere, too, like great virtues in times past, are easily seen today as hideous evils. Let's take, for example, the Inquisition. In its own day, among Catholics, the Holy Inquisition was regarded as we today regard the practice of psychiatry. You feel that in curing a person of cancer, almost anything is justified. The most complex operations, the most weird surgery, people suspended for days and days on end on the end of tubes with X-ray penetration, burning, or people undergoing shock treatment, people locked in the colorless, monotonous corridors of mental institutions. In all good faith, they knew that witchcraft and heresy were terrible things, awful plagues, imperiling people's souls forever and ever. So any means were justified to cure people of heresy. We don't change. We're doing the same thing today, but under different names. We can look back at those people and see how evil that was, but we can't see it in ourselves. So therefore, beware of virtue. Lao Tzu, the Chinese philosopher, said, the highest virtue is not virtue, and therefore really is virtue. But inferior virtue cannot let go of being virtuous, and therefore is not virtue. Translated in more of a periphrastic way, the highest virtue is not conscious of itself as virtue, and therefore really is virtue. Lower virtue is so self-conscious that it's not virtue. In other words, when you breathe, you don't congratulate yourself on being virtuous. But breathing is a great virtue. It's living. When you come out with beautiful eyes, blue or brown or green as the case may be, you don't congratulate yourself for having grown one of the most fabulous jewels on earth. So it's just eyes. And you don't account it a virtue. To see, to entertain the miracles of color and form. You say, oh, that's just... But that's real virtue. Virtue in the sense, the old sense of the word, a strength, is when we talk about the healing virtue of a plant. That's real virtue. But the other virtues are stuck on. They're ersatz, they're imitation virtues. And they usually create trouble. Because more diabolical things are done in the name of righteousness. And be assured that everybody of whatever nationality or political frame of mind or religion always goes to war with a sense of complete rightness. The other side is the devil. Our opponents, whether in China or Russia or Vietnam, have the same feeling of righteousness about what they're doing as we have on our side. and a plague on both houses, because, as Confucius said, the goody-goodies are the thieves of virtue, which is the form of our own proverb, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
I'd like to give our final word to Isabel Patterson from a passage I've read on the air several times over our broadcast history. From her essay, The Humanitarian with the Guillotine, and I quote, "Most of the harm in the world is done by good people and not by accident, lapse, or omission. It is the result of their deliberate actions, long persevered in, which they hold to be motivated by high ideals towards virtuous ends. This is demonstrably true, nor could it occur otherwise. The percentage of positively malignant, vicious, or depraved persons is necessarily small, for no species could survive if its members were habitually and consciously bent upon injuring one another. Destruction is so easy that even a minority of persistently evil intent could shortly exterminate the unsuspected majority of well-disposed persons. Murder, theft, rape, and destruction are easily within the power of any individual at any time. Therefore, it is obvious that in periods when millions are slaughtered, when torture is practiced, starvation enforced, oppression made a policy, as at present over a large part of the world, and as it has been often in the past, it must be at the behest of very many good people, and even by their direct action for what they consider a worthy object. When they are not the immediate executants, they are on record as giving approval, elaborating justifications, or else cloaking facts with silence and discountenancing discussion." End quote. Now, at the heart of this argument is the recognition that too many people regard morality and ethics as a code of values and behaviors that the other guy should adopt in order to get along with the rest of humanity. Personally, I'm not asking that anyone agree with my personal views on religion or morality, or that all religions have to be on the same page when it comes to personal issues of behavior. The impulse and need for that which we call religion is universal, and in the absence of moral codes that have at least been tested in the human marketplace, new religions like woke may fill the gap. And woke, by any objective standard, is not a philosophy or religion of peace and harmony, but of division and strife. But when it comes to the public and political sphere of humanity, only one principle need apply: consent. And a society that operates on that principle is a free society. And as Ayn Rand warned in her essay, Faith and Force, Destroyers of the Modern World, quote, "Anyone who resorts to the formula, it's so because I say so, will have to reach for a gun, sooner or later," end quote. So I wonder if Isabel Patterson ever envisaged a time when the percentage of positively malignant, vicious, or depraved persons became a significant percentage, creating a society with members habitually and consciously bent upon injuring one another. Because that's pretty much where we're at today. And isn't that the reality we should all be uniting to fight against and trying to prevent? If you agree, then you've got a great reason to join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
No, I have learnt my lesson, and that's why I'm going to be woke from now on. It's about time. Well, I'm sorry. Well, I am woke, and now I'm woke, the first thing I've got to do is change my Twitter bio. Because at the moment, it's like a list of the shows I've created. But now I'm woke, I've got to pop in the word anti-fascist. So people know I'm not a fascist. That is a big problem at the moment. People come up to me on the street and they go, "Rick, have you been imprisoning journalists?" I go, "No." They go, "Oh, interesting." They go, "Have you been gassing Jews?" I go, "No." They go, "Well, pop it in your bio then, you silly c***." So yeah, I'm not a fascist. It's an odd thing to just declare, isn't it, that you're not a fascist? We assume, don't we? You wouldn't go up to someone on the street and do that, would you? And go and say, oh, by the way, I'm not a fascist. You know, it's like they protest too much. It's like going into a school and going, I'm not a pedo, so just forget I even mentioned it. So these kids are safe running around me. They can run around naked for all I care. I'm not a pedo, so...